Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and welcome to Larry Batson's Wild World on a February night that we're still snow-laden. It's cold and icy here in Indiana, and I'm officially sick of winter. But we've got more behind us than in front of us, so hopefully in about 3 or 4 weeks we'll be enjoying more spring-like weather. But we've had a kind of an exciting week. In fact, tomorrow we get to go off to the hinterland of Hagerstown, Indiana, to visit the Hagerstown Elementary School. We've got two programs there tomorrow. It's going to seem kind of weird because with all the school cancellations and delays, we haven't had the opportunity to go out and do our thing with the wild animals. So they're all excited about going, and Cheryl and I are too. So we hope to head there in the morning and with the baboon and the bobcat and wolves and pythons and tarantulas. So I know the kids will be excited. You know, I've been doing this now, that's hard to believe, 31 years traveling across the country doing wildlife programs. In fact, each year we see about 200 schools with our collection of wild animals, and we have over the past done, well, some pretty big television programs, Johnny Carson Show, Oprah, Today Show. In fact, we've done this so long. Here's a couple names I know the kids won't remember, but Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin. That's right. They had talk shows. I think the Mike Douglas Show came on like at 2:30 in the afternoon or something here in Indiana. And I can still remember going out to California, and the other guest was Robert Goulet, the noted singer, and he was an interesting character. I think he had about 2 pounds of Crisco on his head. He had that hair slicked back pretty good. But and I'll tell you, one of the nicest folks that we ever met was Merv Griffin. Because when we did his show, he had a cohort, a co-host, Arthur Treacher, you know, just like the old fish and chip place. And he was this old, well-known Englishman that's well-known in England. Of course, being on the Griffin Show, he's became quite well-known here in the States as well. But I can still remember before the taping of the show, he came up and asked about the animals, and we sat and chatted forever. And it was pretty cool. In fact, I have to tell you, the first phone I ever saw in a car was in Merv Griffin's Rolls Royce. And I can still remember that. Of course, it's nothing like what we have now, about the size of a cigarette pack that'll fit in our pocket, but that was pretty cool, seeing the first cell. I don't think you would even call it a cell. I don't know how they did it in those days. Maybe they had a really long wire. I don't know. But that was cool. But tonight, my good friend and technical producer, Eric Altman from Pennsylvania, is going to be sitting in our conversation. How you doing, Eric?
I'm wonderful, Larry. How are you tonight?
What's going on? You didn't sound too wonderful.
Oh, it's been a long day. Spent my afternoon up on the rooftop shoveling off 30-plus inches of snow before the next snowstorm hits.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when's the next one supposed to hit?
Monday?
Yep. Lord. This has been one winter, I'll tell you.
It has been crazy.
I was talking to a fellow in Virginia, and that's before the big blizzard hit Virginia and Washington and New York, and he said that a friend of his who's with Homeland Security was telling him that within the next few days they were expecting 40 inches of snow, And you know he was right. I said, yeah. You've got to be kidding me. Of course, I guess they consider with, you know, we're vulnerable to some extent with all that snow on the ground. I mean, gosh. So I can see whether they'd be concerned with something like that, especially in the Washington, D.C. area.
Certainly, it kind of shuts everything down and kind of puts the kibosh on emergency crews or police departments, ambulance, fire, and all that stuff, getting around quickly and responding quickly to tragedies and events and stuff that might happen.
Well, you know, you talk about an event. I was talking with friends in South Carolina, and they got 6 inches of snow. Now, that's funny. Because she said that they do not know how to drive in snow in South Carolina.
I've been to Georgia, and a very good friend of mine lives in Atlanta. He was telling me that the same thing happens. They get an inch or two of snow that falls, and the whole entire state shuts down.
Paralyzed. Well, you know, I used to make jokes about it here in Indiana because years ago I used to go up to Wisconsin and Minnesota. Well, I did last winter. What am I saying? But I can still remember going to a little town called Rice Lake, Wisconsin. And it's about, three-quarters way up the state. It's north of Eau Claire. And at that time, we had this big trailer that we had remodeled. And we had filled with reptile displays. And not only did we do our program, but we also took this along with us as an exhibit. So we're going up to Rice Lake, Wisconsin, Eric, and I'm telling you. And we went in January, like the end of January. And I'm thinking to myself, and this was really the first big job that I ever went out on, that I ever did. And so we get up there, and I'm telling you, the warmest it got all week was 14 below zero.
Wow.
I mean, when you walk out and every hair in your nose freezes instantly, it's like automatically you've had like cotton balls stuffed up your nose. And those people, they have problems because they like it. they take pride in freezing their tails off. And they all have a cure for what's good for you if when it's that cold. Which all these cures, of course, involve alcohol. So they're all like half souched, I think, half the time. That's how they take this cold weather. And that was also the weirdest thing in Wisconsin, while we're going off subject here, was the pizza. Have you ever eaten a pizza in Wisconsin?
I've never been to Wisconsin.
Oh, well, you've got to go. The pizza, they cut it up in little squares, like bite-sized squares. And I was thinking it was just one of the pizza shops, because in those days we lived on pizza practically. But they cut it everywhere like that. Besides that, they talk funny. I think it's because their tongues freeze to the roof of their mouth. They think it's like it just ain't right. But we took up to Wisconsin live reptiles in January, which you can imagine right there. That's just nuts. Because you're dealing with parcels that you have to keep 70 degrees all the time. And we had the cobras with us. We had rattlesnakes. We had water moccasins and all these snakes. We had giant frogs from Africa. It was really cool. And this display, how it would work is we didn't charge admission, but you walk through the exhibit and you could leave a donation as you leave. And we had a little aquarium there, and we'd have somebody guarding the aquarium. So that their job was just to sit by the aquarium all day and thank everybody and hope they enjoyed the exhibit. In other words, his job also was to guild everybody in a given time. And I'll tell you what, I learned right off the bat, people had really great ways. A lot of times they would use their children to walk by the donation kitty as if they didn't see it. You know, pick it up in their arms and pick it up so their view was blocked of the donation kitty. But we go up to Rice Lake, Wisconsin, and it's like, we get there, and the mall, I don't even think they build malls like this anymore. It had like 20 stores. That was it. So we go up there, you know, and I'm going in the mall, and usually we'd take the trailer and the reptile exhibit in after the mall was closed. They'd open up the big doors, we'd pull it in. But, oh, no, they said that go ahead and bring it in. There's nobody here. And that's not what I'm wanting to hear. I'm thinking, there's nobody in this mall. So we pull the reptile exhibit in there, and we get it all cleaned up and getting it ready for the next day. And the only people that are in the mall, Eric, are mall walkers. And these little old ladies, God love them. And they'd walk by, and they'd look inside the trailer. And we didn't have any of the signage up yet. And they'd say, what's that? And I'd say, oh, they're reptiles, man. Reptiles, you know, snakes and stuff. Ooh, snakes. Who'd want to look at those? And I'm thinking, we're going to die up here. We're not going to make any donations. It's just going to be a slow death. So we in those days, we'd do like four lectures a day. So we had a little lion with us, and I'm trying to think what else, a parrot, some other things, a kinkajou probably, a little funny little prehensile tail animal from South America. And so we're sitting there, and next day we're doing our shows. And we do the first show for probably the guy that owns the jewelry store, the guy that owns the hardware, a few mall walkers, maybe 10 people. And I'm just dying. I'm thinking, this is not going to be good. And the second show wasn't much better. It was like at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So we go out, look for some food, and we find a burger joint. We've taken burgers back for the help, and we pull up by the mall, and we notice the parking lot's full. So here's what I thought, Eric. Here's my brilliant mind working. I'm thinking, oh, it's bingo night. Place is full of bingo players. But it wasn't, because we walk into the mall. We're walking where we got the exhibit set up, and we're walking by where our stage was to do our show. And there's like hundreds of people standing around the stage. And I'm looking over at our little reptile exhibit we had set up in the little aquarium where they walk out. It's full of paper money.
Wow.
To the top. And I look at the kid. I go, what happened? He goes, I have no idea. He says they started showing up. They started walking. Look at this. And I guess that morning, the local radio personality was one of the people in the audience for the show. So I guess when he did his afternoon shift, that's all he talked about, is how everybody needs to go to the mall and see the animal show and the reptile exhibit. And it was packed all week. I mean,
great.
It was unbelievable. I thought, and, you know, Wisconsin people are the nicest folks.
Okay.
So it was cool. It was really cool. But anyway, tonight's subject is danger snakes. And I kind of led into that in a way, you know. But for 30, gosh, even longer than that, even before I started traveling doing lectures and before we created Wildlife Educational Services, I collected reptiles. I had them, and my goal was to try and figure out a way to make a living with reptiles. And at one time I housed probably, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, probably 40 different species of venomous snakes.
Wow.
As well as pythons and boa constrictors and giant frogs and all this. But I always had an intrigue for the venomous snakes, because there's a certain beauty to all of these things. And of course, when you look at one close, you realize what a sophisticated hunting machine these things are. Not only their ability to kill their prey, but also their camouflage. And I used to say that if you see a rattlesnake in the wild that's 4 or 5 feet long, you have to think to yourself that you're probably one of the first humans to see that snake. Because usually when people see something like that, their first instinct, their first inclination, of course, this has changed recently, is to kill it. I mean, I haven't talked to anybody that's lived down in the hills of Hoosier National Forest here in Indiana, or Morgan Monroe State Forest, that, you know, not unless they're herpetologists and are interested in reptiles, most of them say, man, I saw a rattlesnake, I had to kill it. It was either in my yard or so forth. And here in Indiana, we have what you have in Pennsylvania, the timber rattlesnake. Have you ever run into any rattlesnakes in your trips through the hills of Pennsylvania?
One.
Just one?
Just one, and it was this past August that we came very, very close to stepping on it. Never saw it, never heard it until it was almost too late. We got very lucky.
Well, that's the thing about the timber rattlesnake. They're pretty mild-tempered. In fact, the first one I ever caught in the wild, I was, it was a rainy day. In fact, I didn't even have any snake hunting equipment with me. I was down there to collect box turtles. In fact, luckily, I had stopped at a friend's place in Bloomington, Indiana, just before that, and he had a bunch of aquariums he wanted to sell me. And they had these locking screen tops, and I had two or three of them in the back of my pickup when I was down there. And it's raining, you know, and I'm walking. It's really a good, great time to look for box turtles because that's when they're active. But so I'm walking around there in the woods, not too far from my truck, in this clearing. All of a sudden, I look down, and there's this beautiful yellow snake coiled up. And I realized at that moment it was a timber rattlesnake. And I'll tell you what, Eric, it never even rattled. So I'm looking at it, you know, and I'm thinking like 73, 74 maybe. About 4 years before I really got involved doing what I do now. And this snake, so I'm wanting to capture it. And I've never really handled venomous snakes before. This is my first time. So I'm looking around for a stick or something because I had no reptile handling equipment with me at all. And I'll tell you what, I pinned his head and I instincts told me pretty much how to do that. You have to be very careful when you pin their head because they have these two capillaries in their neck that if you pin it too hard, they'll break and the snake won't die instantly. It'll just be a slow process. In a week or so, it'll pass away. So I pin this snake, and I pick it up. And what's wild about these pit vipers, of course, they open right up, and you see those two hypodermic fangs, you know, and they're twisting their head from side to side trying to grab you in the thumb. Clip your thumb is what they try to do. Mm-hmm. So I had a hold of him, and luckily I had one of those green-top aquariums in the back of that truck, so I opened one of those up while I'm holding the snake, and I got him in there and got the lid closed and got it locked and everything. And this is the God's truth, Eric. I couldn't talk for like 5 minutes.
Hmm.
It was like such an adrenaline rush. It was like unbelievable. But it was exciting. And then I thought to myself, you know, that was fun. I said, that's a lot more fun than fishing or something like that. So it wasn't long after that I just totally got, I started doing so much research, and I put quite a collection together of venomous snakes. We had, in fact, I can still remember one of my good friends, he used to send me reptiles from West Palm Beach. In fact, he literally raised 10 children, had a big family. By collecting reptiles out of the Everglades, or around the Everglades, I should say, and shipping them all over the world. He had collectors in New York and Europe and Japan, Germany. It's amazing the amount of clientele and people in other parts of the country where herpetology is such a important hobby or occupation or whatever. So he'd ship these things all over the world. So he would send me reptiles. And in fact, I can still remember he sent me. It was the biggest eastern diamondback rattlesnake that I'd ever seen. It was close to 7 feet long. If you took your hand and held it flat and rolled your fingers up, that would be about the size of his head. His head was massive.
Wow.
It had to be 3.5, 4 inches across, easily. And a snake like that, its body's about the size of a boa constrictor. I mean, it was just an incredible snake. Huge rattle. I think it had 12, 13, 14 rattles on it. And it was one of these snakes that you knew that if it got you, you were done. Because a snake that size has fangs that are... It was just a trip. So I'm deciding, we're getting ready to go to St. Louis, Missouri. I'm deciding I'm going to take this big snake with me to do for my show. So we go to St. Louis, and we were in a shopping mall. I don't do those anymore.
I don't think there are those anymore.
No, they don't. Yeah, it's all changed now. But it was in Florissant, Missouri. I still remember, and I think it was the Jamestown Mall, something like that. And so I had this big Eastern Diamondback, and the stage, they literally had a skylight over the stage. So there was like a beam of sunshine that went right down this stage. Now, normally this snake was not too bad to handle. I mean, he was for his size, because, I mean, he could strike 3, 3.5 feet. If you were within 3, 3.5 feet of him, he'd get you, no doubt. But with his skylight, when I'd bring him out of the box, it was like he was back in the Glades. He would come to life, and he was striking, and he really put on one heck of a show. And the stage wasn't that big, so there was a couple really close calls. In fact, it got so bad. Nowadays, it wouldn't be like that. I've got another 30 years of experience handling snakes, but... The shoe salesmen were taking bets on which show I was going to get bit during. So that's how exciting and hairy it was. So I finished the second time of the show with it, and it was just like crazy. So the guy that was with me said, "Wow!" I said, "That snake." He says, "Why don't you just use that timber rattlesnake that you have?" And I caught a timber rattlesnake in southern Indiana that was about 6 feet. In fact, it was a state record at one time. It was 76 inches long when it passed away a few years ago. But he said, "Why don't you just use that?" So I'm thinking, well, you know, you may have a point. I'll let this one kind of calm down a little bit. I'll get him out when we're not in front of an audience and figure out what gets him fired up and just go from there. Maybe for the night show and those big skylight coming down on the stage, it won't be so much of a problem. So I go into the reptile exhibit, and I'm going to get the timber rattlesnake. And I did probably the dumbest thing that I've ever done. Now, I didn't have enough hands for one thing. So I'm putting this snake in a bag. I got him, his head started in the snake bag. And of course, the snake bags is nothing more than a pillowcase, maybe a little deeper. And this snake's crawling down inside the bag, and I've got a hold of my left hand, I've got a hold of the lip of the bag. It's still open. So with my right hand, I'm closing the cage door because there's a couple of the rattlesnakes in there. So I look over, and what had happened is this big timber rattlesnake had crawled up the side of the bag, and his head was hanging out of the bag over the lip. Basically, his neck was over the lip, and there was his head just there within inches of me. So I don't know what I was thinking, but what I did, and like I said, this was the stupidest thing I've ever done, is I took the flat of my hand, because I had no snake hook. It was leaning against the wall. And I literally took the flat of my hand and patted him on the nose and knocked him back down to the bag, was what my thinking was, with the flat of my hand. As soon as I touched his nose and knocked him back into the bag with the flat of my hand, he come back out of the bag and buried a fang in my palm.
Oh.
Yeah. So, and it was quick. I mean, it was quick. He didn't get me with two. He only got me with one. So, you know, right away I'm thinking, oh, my God. So I get the bag, I get him on in the bag, I get the bag tied up, I get the snake secured. That's the biggest thing when you're handling venomous reptiles. If you should have an accident, if you should have a problem, your main thing is to secure the snake and worry about yourself later. So I got that done. So I walk out of the trailer, and I'm getting ready to do a lecture. So I'm thinking to myself, well, let's see, because 25% of the time when these snakes bite you, they do what's called a dry bite, no venom at all. So I'm thinking to myself, I'll go ahead and do the show. If I start feeling bad, then I'll go to the hospital if I have to. So I'm kind of standing around and stuff and looking at it. And it's pretty much, quit bleeding, because it's basically like getting a hypodermic shot. It's a really small wound. But I don't know. I get about 5 minutes before I'm ready to do my show. I'm not feeling very good at all. So my plan was, maybe I'll go to the hospital. I'll have them look at me, and then I'll come back and do that show that night. So what I do is I go to the mall office. And I walk in there, I said, I had a little accident. And they ask what happened. I said, well, I was bitten by a timber rattlesnake inside the exhibit, not where the public is, in the service area. And I said, I'm going to have to cancel this show, but I'm going to go to the hospital, and I'll be back for tonight's show. I said, if anybody asks, I said, just tell them I've caught the flu or something. So we load up. I get taken to the hospital, I'm trying to keep this low-key. I don't want anybody to know what's going on. Well, heck, we pull up there, and there's two or three hospital people waiting for me. They wheel me right into the emergency room. They got me stretched out on a table. There was no waiting around. And they're looking and looking and looking, and it's already started to swell. In fact, the swelling, basically my entire arm turned black. The swelling at the elbow was, I think they said, 10 inches larger. So it gives you a general idea what a mess it was. So I go into the emergency room, and one of the things that they do is they have to make sure you're not allergic to the antivenin, the serum that they're going to give you that will battle the venom that's been released in me from the snake. So I tell them what type of snake it is, and they get the antivenin. And I knew that I had a problem because they said, hold him down. Because what they had to do was the lance, the area where I was bitten, which was in the palm of my hand, which next to the bottom of your feet is the toughest skin on your body. And I will have to say, the most painful part of the whole ordeal is when they had held me down, and this doctor came up with a scalpel, and he lanced my palm. That was the only time, I think, during the whole ordeal that I actually let out a word that I could say on this program, but I won't. And they started trying to suck as much of the poison, but it had been over an hour, so basically the poison had circulated through my body. And in case you're ever, ever, ever bitten by a poisonous snake, the one thing you don't want to do is do the lance and then have your friend try to suck out. Don't ever do that. Don't use cold compresses. Don't put your arm in ice. Basically, the best thing to do is to let the venom go throughout your body, and basically it dilutes it. So they gave me the antivenin, and the antivenin, it turns out, they've given me enough for an elephant, because basically they don't see snake bite that often, and they were like reading a cookbook as they're treating me. And I can still remember coming out of the emergency room, and they're taking me to intensive care. The nurse she says, "Do you have a religious preference?" And I looked up at her and I said, "I'm not going to die. I've got a show to do tomorrow." And the doctor looks up. He says, "No, you'll be doing those shows for a while." And he was right, because they kept me in intensive care for 3 days and the hospital for the 6 days. And here I am getting out of the emergency room. They're putting me in intensive care, and a nurse walks in. And I told the shopping mall, I said, you know, just tell them I caught the flu or something. I'll be back tomorrow. Well, I guess the newspaper had called the hospital because the mall had called the newspaper, the television stations, to tell them what had happened. And the nurse walks in. She says, well, Mr. Batson, she said, the newspaper's on the phone. I said, don't tell them anything. They said, they want some particulars on you. Don't tell them anything. She said, well, if I don't tell them something, they'll just make it up. And I said, how did they find out? He said, or she said, the shopping mall called them. And Eric, all that time, my sorry butt was in that hospital. The shopping mall was packed. It had drawn such a crowd. The reptile exhibit, it did pretty good. And one of the guys working for me had to do the shows all week, and he'd come up to my room, and what do I say? So I had to basically write the show for him. Then they take me out of intensive care, and they put me in a regular room. Well, he comes up thinking I'm still in intensive care. So he walks up to where my bed was, and they had the curtain drawn back because they're probably cleaning up the carnage or whatever. And he walks up behind the nurse, and the only thing he said was, did he die? She turned around, and she goes, who? She goes, Larry Batson. Oh, she says, oh, no, he's up in a regular room. So that was my experience with, I'm glad I can laugh about it now, with venomous snakes.
That's why I don't like snakes.
I have great fascination. I've got more great stories we're going to share, and we're going to take a break. Some PSAs. I'm going to go get a cold beverage. This is Larry Batson's Wild World, and you're listening to Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing, so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals, without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
Thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everybody. This is Larry Batson. Welcome to Larry Batson's Wild World on a rather crisp at night here in Indiana. I think most of the country, all this crazy snow and everything. But co-hosting with me tonight is my good friend and also technical producer, Eric Altman from Pennsylvania. We got any calls yet tonight, Eric?
No, not tonight. We have one caller who's called in through a Skype number, and they're just listening to the show. No, we don't have any callers and no questions from the chat room this evening.
Oh, well, I guess that's the way it goes.
Hey, we can throw out that phone number if anybody wants to call in.
Oh, well, yeah, it's... what is that? Wait a minute, I have it right here. Hold on. 347-855-8123. I act like I've never done anything like this before. I'm a little strayed because I decided to, I went through my library because I figured it would be an inspiration. There's a book by a herpetologist called Poisonous Snakes, which real is the correct term is venomous snakes. So I'm leafing through this book, Eric, and God, it brings back great memories. I'm seeing some of these species of snakes that I've worked with. Many, many years ago, there was a world-renowned herpetologist who was based here in Indiana. His name is Dr. Sherman Minton, and he was one of the most foremost authorities on venomous snakes in the world. In fact, he wrote a guide for the Navy, which I have somewhere. I was looking for that as well. And what I would do is... he was doing these experiments with the blood of venomous snakes, so I would take over different things that I had, or he'd come out to my snake house, and we'd take blood samples from things like cotton mouths and whatever I had, diamondbacks. Well, like I said, at one time I had about 35 species of snakes, and I can still remember he'd been on a trip to Asia, and he brought back and gave to me what is considered next to the sea snake. Well, on land, it is the most venomous snake in the world, and it's called a krait, and they're found in the rainforest of Borneo and Sumatra throughout Southeast Asia. It's spelled K-R-A-I-T, and they kind of look like a coral snake, except they're yellow and black, and they're basically... When they talk about the two-step snake, this is what they had in mind. Luckily, they have very small fangs, and all the times that I ever handled this snake, it was I never really felt it was dangerous because it was basically during the daytime is pretty placid. I mean, it wasn't aggressive whatsoever. Now, at night, when it was in darkness, its reflexes quickened remarkably, and you could really tell that. That also would happen with coral snakes from Florida. We'd get those eastern coral snakes, great big ones. In fact, they would be 36, 40 inches long. Of course, red, black, and yellow, rednecks to black, Brenda Jack, rednecks to yellow, you could be a dead guy. However that rhyme works. But I can remember going down to this fella. He was based in, I want to think, Rusk, Florida. His name was Ray Singleton, and he was at that time one of the top animal dealers in the country. And he had a snake room, and he sold snakes. So here, a couple guys were walking in there, and here comes old Ray Singleton in his Hawaiian shirt. His glasses were about 3 inches thick, and he was quite the character. In fact, when we first walked up, he had an opossum by the neck, and he looked at it and said, "This will be fine for the University of Iowa." And he was sending possums to Iowa for some type of, I don't know what they were doing, but he had cages and cages full of possums he'd caught out of the Everglades. So we asked him, I said, "Do you have any snakes for sale right now?" He said, "Oh, sure do." And I want to tell you, the snake room wasn't very big. It was maybe 15 feet by 30 feet. And this man, I learned more in probably 10 minutes watching him handling snakes on what not to do. He had this aquarium filled with cypress mulch. And in it was just probably a dozen or so coral snakes. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the coral snake, Eric, but that is the most venomous snake in the U.S. And they're very toxic. They're just not very aggressive. They only come out at night, and they hide down in old tree bark, and they hunt lizards. That's their primary diet. So I told him, I said, "Well, I'd be interested in getting a couple of coral snakes." So he reaches in the aquarium, and he's fishing for them like he was fishing for night crawlers.
Jeez.
I'm watching him do this barehanded.
Wow.
And I'm watching him do this, you know, and not really saying anything, just observing. And he says, "Oh, they're fine in the daytime." And I'm watching him. Well, that's one thing I've learned about handling snakes today. And then he also had about a 6.5-foot Asian cobra that I wanted really bad. So we had to put that in a bag. And cobras are very, very tricky to handle because if you go into a room with a rattlesnake, the rattlesnake basically coils up in the corner. He just rattles at you, and he's on a defensive stance. The cobra, he'll just chase you, depending on the species and the temperament of the snake that day. I mean, he'll come up on the hood, and he'll just crawl after you. I mean, and king cobras are even more aggressive than that. They'll come up on their hood and just sit there, and then when they breathe, it basically sounds like a freight train, very loud, resonant breathing. And, of course, they open their mouth, and then they'll strike at you and so forth. So I think he had me hold the bag. He says, "You hold the bag, and I'll maneuver his head inside of the bag. And then we'll get it closed up there pretty quick, you know." So, you know, I hold the bag. So I'm holding the bag, and he's got the cobra by the tail. Now the head, he's got a snake hook, which is kind of like a golf club with this little hook on the end, so you can control the head somewhat. And there he is. That cobra's just flailing around. And I'm holding the bag open as wide as I can. And I'm not really looking. I'm just looking straight ahead because I'm thinking, don't move, you know, don't screw this up. And eventually we got the snake in the bag and got it tied up. And that was pretty interesting,
I'd say.
But what was really wild on that particular trip, I mentioned a little bit earlier about my friend who raised 10 children by collecting snakes. He said, "Let's go snake collecting tonight." And he was a master. I mean, he knew the science of it. He knew this one particular road. Of course, what you would do is you'd look for a road that was next to canals. And at night, what would happen if the temperature was right and the moon and all this, the snakes would literally crawl from the canal up onto the road to the other side of the road to the next canal. And this road that he would travel, he told me, he says, Larry, he says, we have from dark to about 30 minutes when these snakes are moving. That's it. After that time, they quit moving. So he had all these old Volkswagen buses. And the bus didn't have any doors in it. For the reason is, the idea is we'd cruise up and down the road in the Volkswagen bus. If we saw a snake, he'd kind of slow down a little bit while you hopped out. You'd run, grab the snake, toss it in a bag, and then jump back in the bus because there's bound to be another one on down the road. And you only had this 30, 40-minute time frame to catch these snakes. So we were doing that. He looked off, said, right side of the road, he said, yellow rat snake, non-venomous, no problem. So I'm running out of the truck, grab the snake. It's dark. I mean, you can't see anything except the silhouette of the snake and the headlights. So I grab the snake, throw it in the bag, climb back in the truck, and another one. So we're going down the road, and he says to me, he says, water snake, right? So I hop out of the truck, and I'm running up to it, and I can just see the silhouette of this snake. But you know that little voice that none of us listen to enough tells me, don't just grab it. So I told him, I says, hey, Ron, hit a flashlight on this one. So he turns on his flashlight, shines it on the road, and shines it on the snake. And that water snake that I almost grabbed, going to toss it in a bag, turned out was an eastern pygmy rattlesnake. Ooh. And I told him, I says, Ron, I said, that's not funny. He says, I can still remember what he said. Whoops. So I didn't trust him anymore that night. I mean, I was grabbing that flashlight. Because, you know, I don't mind getting bit by just a non-venomous snake, but those venomous snakes, those are expensive bites. Those are expensive accidents. Yep. And the thing about that little pygmy rattlesnake is their venom, if they grew to be, they only grow 20 inches, 24 inches at max, maybe a little bigger. But if they grew to be 5 or 6 feet long, they'd be a bad snake. Because the venom is almost like an insect venom. It's very, very toxic. And what happened a lot of times, people bitten by those snakes, is they get shipped in with plants. They'll crawl up in the base of a potted plant and put them on a truck and send them off to Mechanicsburg, Illinois at the Walmart, and they'll set out the potted plants and they'll be somebody will get bit. It's happened before.
Right.
So, yeah.
Hey, Larry, let me interrupt you real quick. We do have a call waiting if you want to take it.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll go to the Skype caller here and bring them on the air with us here. Skype caller, you're on the air with Larry Batson.
Hi, Larry. Eric, it's Abe. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Want to say very interesting show. I myself was a member of the Minnesota Herpetological Society for, once upon a time. And I just want to say that it's a very interesting show that you have, and quite a working with the venomous snakes and everything like that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I could go around picking up venomous snakes or anything like that. If I had the chance and the correct know-how to do so, I probably would. But as far as herpetology goes, I usually do the lizards, the skinks, the turtles, and things of that nature. And I just thought I'd call in and say great job, show my support.
Well, we appreciate that. I'll tell you, the venomous snakes, as far as keeping them in captivity, after a while, you just see, man, what remarkably beautiful snakes these things are. You know, one of the most dangerous snakes, I'm sure you've heard of, a Gaboon viper?
Is that kind of related to the boomslang?
No, they're related to puff adders, which happen to be the most common and most, one of the most dangerous snakes in Africa.
Yeah, the death adders, yes.
The death adder's a little different deal. That's the one from Australia. But the puff adder is found throughout Africa, and basically they are a big snake. They grow 4 or 5 feet long, and when you get close to them, they make this breathing sound. It basically sounds like a vacuum cleaner, and they'll fill their body up with air. And what's remarkable about the puff adder is that they can strike so fast from the sideways position. Like rattlesnakes, for instance, when I work with them, I always work dead on because they don't strike side to side. They strike straight at you.
Yep.
So I work dead on with those. But for the puff adder, he's a little different character. I mean, he can strike quicker sideways. And what makes them so dangerous in Africa is that they live in this tall grass, and their coloring, they're invisible. And people practically just step on them because they don't crawl away. They just stay right there. And when they have young, they have live young, and they'll have 30, 40 live young.
Wow.
Which from the moment they're born, they're capable of delivering a death. In fact, of all the snakes in Africa, puff adders are responsible for the most bites. And probably, I haven't looked up lately, probably the most deaths. But they've got that close relative, the gaboon viper. Now, he's a whole different deal. He's about 6 feet long. He has a fang that's well over, I think the record is an inch and a half.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. They bite clear through your hand. I mean, they hit you on the top of your hand. The tip of the fang's coming through the bottom. Now she hit bone. And they've got the most beautiful colors. I mean, it's like blues, creams, and greens. I mean, they're just remarkable snakes. And I can still remember being down in Florida, and I walked into a fellow, his name is Charles Chase. At that one time, he's one of the biggest animal importers in the country. And he had one that was well over 6 foot long. And I sat there and I just stared at this snake. I mean, I had to be for a half hour because it was just so remarkable. It was so beautiful. And of course, when you look at something like that, you realize, man, what that thing is capable of doing. And in the wild, they're very difficult to collect because they hide so well. And they're just a remarkable, remarkable snake. But all those snakes, the puff adders and gaboon vipers, and also a little guy called the rhinoceros viper, which is very, very colorful. And he's found in the tropics of Africa, and it's more of a forest snake. And I can remember keeping those in my collection, along with my gaboon vipers and my puff adders. And I think of all the venomous snakes, though I do love the rattlesnakes, I think they were probably next to my favorites, without a doubt.
Wow. Have you ever worked with any snakes from South America, like the lanceheads or anything?
Well, Yes, I have. I worked with we got these snakes from Argentina. I had a good friend in Pennsylvania, which I found out recently passed away. He was a big-time reptile dealer. And he called up and said, hey, I've got these Nuides vipers, and they're related to ferdelances.
Yep.
Now, ferdelances get huge, you know, 9-10 foot long snake.
Yeah.
They have 80 to 90 young in the wild, and the sugarcane workers down in South America and up through Central America, that's their main thing they're concerned with, is a ferdelance. And it's not a very pretty snake, but it's a very hot-tempered snake. Well, he said, these aren't quite as big as the ferdelances, and he called them Nuides vipers. They were, for the herpetologists and the elders, you know, it was Bothrops Nuidi Deporus, I think, was the Latin name on them. And they weren't very pretty, but what was remarkable about them, they'd get in a coil, and they'd move their head back, and then their tail, they would shake it like a rattlesnake,
yeah.
And they would get this vibration going, where literally it looked like the whole body was almost like one of those things, that those round deals that people drive around, it's propelled with air. That's how the snake's body was. And its strike at least half the length of its body with no warning. I mean, it was just like boom, boom, boom. Or then sometimes you'd be cleaning its cage or just taking care of it. It wouldn't do anything. Another time, it'd just be nuts. But it was quite the remarkable snake. It wasn't very pretty, but it was certainly, it got my attention without a doubt. It was a very interesting snake to deal with.
Have you ever worked with Steve Irwin down in Australia?
Well, Steve Irwin, no, I never had the opportunity. he was, you know, he was, what a communicator, and what an educator. And when he died, it really, for all the people that do wildlife education work, essentially what Steve does, I mean, he took it to the ultimate.
Yeah.
I mean, between his television show and, you know, you get him aside, he was a completely different critter. You know, that was basically all the danger, that was just TV. He wasn't like that in reality.
Right.
But he had a phobia about buildings. In fact, when I was working with Mutual of Omaha, the PR person had to do some things with him in Chicago, and they told me that they were getting ready to do a television shot, and they couldn't find him. They couldn't find him in the building. They walked up to his wife, and they said, where's Steve at? She says, well, he doesn't really like to be in buildings. And he probably had to go for a walk, and when will he be back? She goes, I really couldn't tell you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I kind of grew up some of my teen years watching him and some of his work, and I highly respected the guy. Larry, if you had to make a list of the top 10 poisonous snakes in the world, this is my last question, what would they be?
Probably king cobra, gaboon viper, soft-scaled viper, banded krait, sea snake, taipan, black mamba, green mamba. I know I'm pretty close to 10. Puff adder, for sure. And the tropical rattlesnake of South America, or the cascabel. And the most dangerous snake we have in the United States, I still think, because of its not very nice disposition and its wide range, is a western diamondback rattlesnake found throughout Texas and Arizona and New Mexico. And it's responsible for a lot of bites, especially at the roundups they have. But what's wild now is a lot of these roundups, they're actually having to import snakes in because they've been so over-collected that the rabbit populations have gone nuts in certain parts of the Southwest where they used to have these roundups. Now the ranchers aren't so keen when they see a rattlesnake to get out their gun and kill it because they're beginning to realize the importance of this thing in the wild. It's like all animals.
All right.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate you listening.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I guess I'll see you at the conference, Eric.
Yep.
You
looking forward to it, Abe.
Bye.
Take care.
Well, Eric, I'm going to tell you, this has brought back a lot of memories. I could talk about this for days, I think. It's such an intriguing subject, in fact.
Certainly is. Before we go real quick, I want to share with you my one and only timber rattlesnake experience. And it was pretty exciting, but also kind of spooky for me, scary for me, because I'm not a big fan of snakes or spiders. I despise both of them. But this past August, a friend of mine and I were out hiking in central Pennsylvania in the mountains, just out for a Sunday afternoon hike in the woods, and as we were walking along this little rocky outcrop, we came across, I got this really tingling sensation in my arms, like there was something there, and I said, hey, my senses just kind of went crazy, and turned to walk and step off the trail into the rocky outcrop, and the snake jumped. It didn't jump at us, it jumped away from us, and my friend started poking at it with a stick, trying to get it to turn and take some pictures, but I hightailed it out of there.
You left.
So that was my experience with a timber rattler snake. One and only out of 15 years I've been in the woods looking for, you know, wild animals.
Well, you know, too, they're protected now in Pennsylvania, I believe. And that's one snake that, from over-collection over the years, it's definitely paid a toll. In fact, here in Indiana, they're classified as an endangered species or protected. You can't kill one, you can't catch one, and which I think is all good.
All good.
Next week on the show, we're going to have bass fishing and all that's to look forward to. That will remind us of summer with Dan White from the Bass Pro Shop and Tracker Boats, and he's going to be on. We're going to talk to him about bass fishing, also his old adventures as being an Indiana conservation officer. That'll be happening on Blog Talk Radio. Larry Batson's Wild World also coming up. Ophie, Finocchi, Joe, Peter Gross from the Wild Kingdom television program. It's all going to be here. Eric, have a great week, buddy.
My you too, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for all of your help. And this is Larry Batson. This is Larry Batson's Wild World, and you've been listening to Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.